Good evening, friends. My name is Jay Stennett, and I'm an alcoholic. And the theme is don't suck. Interesting. I bring you greetings from the Sedona Reflections Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet every Saturday morning at 8 a.m. And if you're ever in Sedona, come and join us. We have a really good time. And I'm just thrilled to be here. I was taught early on in Alcoholics Anonymous to just say yes. And it's odd where you end up. You know, here I am with you. So I bring you greetings from my fabulous wife, Adele. And Adele has been on the path for, on June the 28th, she'll be 25 years sober. And I came to you on the second day of May in 1979. And although I've found it necessary on a lot of occasions, I have not taken the first drink, sniffed any glue, or done any of those other things that I found to be so consoling. So my experience is that you don't ever have to pick up one day at a time from the time that you come here. And there's no hierarchy. One is not better or worse. This is just my story, and I've been asked to tell you my story, so that's what you're going to get. When I have the privilege of doing something like this, there are so many places that we're going to get to go this weekend. But just to set you up first, I will tell you that God has two languages. The first is silence, and the second is laughter. And so I hope that this weekend we're going to spend a little time in silence, and hopefully we'll spend a lot of time laughing. Because it's in that identification, that laughing, that I became present in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was sitting at a meeting I maybe had 3 weeks, or no, three, yeah, maybe 3 weeks sober. And there was a guy talking, and he said that there had been lots of old-timers that had passed in the neighborhood during those days. And he said, everybody's talking about that John and Cheryl have gone to the big meeting in the sky. He said, I don't believe in the big meeting in the sky. He said, I think we can all drink. He said, Bill W. is tending bar. Dr. Bob is handing out pills in the bathroom. And Sister Ignatia's doing table dances. And like, I was very, very, you know, I wasn't even smoking during Chapter 5 in those days. And I started to laugh. And it came from between my toes. And I hadn't laughed deeply in a very, very long time. And that's when I really came into Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, the first part, I'm going to qualify, tell you a little bit about me and how a nice guy like, well, how a guy like me got around nice people like you. Couple of things. If I'm talking too fast, because when I get excited, sometimes I start going and going and going, just go like this. And that'll mean, get some space in there, dude, so that I can slow down a little bit. Because I'm an odd man, I come from an odd country, and we speak an odd, odd language. And and then if you can't hear me, just go like this. And then I'll try and perk it up a little bit. So I was born in El Segundo, California. which, if you need a reason to drink, is as good as any. On the north side of the town is the Los Angeles International Airport. On the east side is the defense contractors. On the south side of the city is the second oil refinery in the state of California. That's how the town got its name. And then on the little stretch of beach between El Segundo and the Pacific Ocean is the waste treatment plant for the entire county of Los Angeles. So toxicity is just a way of life. And you want to get right with your environment, right? And so I did. Now, much like our fabulous first speaker, alcoholism doesn't run in my family. It gallops. And my mother's people are Scots. My father's people are from the hills of Kentucky. And our family tree kind of looks like a palm. And thank you. And so there's no problem with drinking in our family. My dad was a really good-looking man that moved real quick. And my mother was beautiful and needed a drink really badly and didn't take it. So the violence in our home came from the unrecovered Al-Anon. And for whatever their weirdness was, they taught me good table manners. They made sure I went to school, that I got my homework done. They fed me, and they introduced me to God as they understood God. Thank you. And I love it when the sound effects work. And, you know, so I didn't have any problem at all when I was growing up, from the outside looking in, just as you said. But by the time I was 8 years old, it was very, very clear to me that the family that I was living in was not matching up to what I was getting told in church and in school. So I made a decision that when I am in front of these people, I will play their game, and when I'm not, I'll do what I damn well please. This tends to get one to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I was the short guy in school. I don't know if you remember the short guy. I can't throw the ball as far. I can't run as fast. But when I'm 12 years old, I find something I can do better than guys that are bigger and tougher and stronger than me. Metabolize beverage alcohol. Obviously, this is a gift from God. And when one is gifted, one pursues it. Now, I don't know that I'm alcoholic. I don't know that what I have is a physical allergy to alcohol. An allergy is described as an abnormal reaction to a substance. And when I drink, I react abnormally. And it's very interesting how it is that that works. And so when I come across people and they say, well, how do I know if I'm alcoholic or not? Well, we don't diagnose others. But I say, take a look at what you do for fun. And then look at what happens when most normal people do that. Now, by the time I'm 16 years old, my idea of a good time was to take a rack of Reds, three high-powered sedatives, barbiturates, and wash it down with a quart of Spignata wine. Now, in 90% of the population, they figure that alcoholics are about 10 to 12% of the population. I just learned that there's a codependent generation. Who knew? But it's about 10 to 12% of the population. In that other 90%, if they take those pills and they wash it down with a quart of wine, they end up in hospital. With me, I'm looking for car keys and to make short-term romantic commitments. Which brings me to a second point about this physical allergy that I have, this alcoholism. I don't suffer, but others suffer from blackouts. How do you say that in Swedish?
Blackouts.
Good. Now, what a blackout is is it's the short-term memory does not link to the long-term memory. Okay, that bridge gets washed out. So, if you have ever woken up with a life form with which you were unfamiliar when you left the house that morning, you might suffer from this allergy to alcohol. Now, most people, if they wake up with somebody they don't know, they think this might be a serious problem. With me, I come up with coping behaviors, like, would you please give me your phone number? Hoping they write down their name, right? Now, I know that this never happens in Sweden. But you wake up, and there's chaps. How do you say chaps in Swedish? You know the things that the bikers wear? Those. I don't even like motorcycles. Oh, my God. But, you know, fortunately for me, it was the 70s. It was just a phase. It was not a lifestyle. But, I mean, I just think that this is part of the... This is what drinking does. I don't really have any problem with this. Now think about that. You got to be just a little bit off center to think, because this was not an occasional occurrence. I was just an affectionate kind of alcoholic. So... There are these blackouts. I drink and I take drugs in a way that most people end up in hospital, and I'm just out having a good time. And I have no idea that what is happening is that I am gradually eroding away my soul. I have a soul sickness. And it's very, very fine, and it grinds very, very slowly. And so it ended up that I was living in my Pinto. Now, a Pinto was a smart car that Ford built for alcoholics back in the 70s. It was very compact, highly flammable. And I'm going around and I'm stealing gasoline and alcohol. And that's my idea of how to get from one day to the next. I violated the trust of anybody that ever put any in me. And that's not how I was raised. That's not the kind of guy that I wanted to be. I had no idea that the reason that I kept ending up in these situations was alcoholism. I thought what I was a bad guy getting what I deserve. I had no idea that one drink's too many and 1,000's not enough. Now, I qualified as an alcoholic. You got that? I got a little problem with the drink. I also, by the time I was 16 years old, was sticking needles in my arm. That's how smart a kid I was. And fortunately, that didn't last a long time, but I can guarantee you that I never did that without having a little something to drink first, just to take the edge off. So, I'm living in my car, and I get arrested again. Now, when I talk about getting arrested, I'm not talking about prison. I'm talking about really high crimes. Drunk in public, drunk in auto, drunk driving, public napping. Those kinds of things. But I could not go 90 days without somebody saying, get in the car. And it was the police. Get in the car. And so I got to go down, you know, come up with the bail, get out, you know, all that stuff. And no matter where I moved, that same thing was going on. And I can't get a clue. And people are talking to me about my drinking. Now, my drinking is the only thing that makes me feel worthwhile. It's the only thing. And people are asking me to stop. You might as well tell me to stop breathing, because that's about how I act. And I only stopped drinking once before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I took a pledge, and I was really fortunate that my great-grandfather died 2 days later. And in grief, I picked up. Never even thought about it again. So I got arrested again, and my father was kind enough to meet me, and we were talking. We met in a bar, because that's where we meet, and over a vodka on ice, he said to me, do you think you have the disease? And I looked at him, and the still small voice, that still small voice that every person that I've ever had an honest conversation with said, pay really close attention. He might pay for the lawyer. And so I said, I don't know. And he said, I'd like you to talk to a friend of mine. Okay. I was not in the position not to talk to anyone. And he said, I've checked with my mother. You can stay with her. We were up in Northern California, and this guy was down in Southern California. And he said, go talk to him. So I went to my grandmother's house, where all real gangsters end up, either at mom's or grandma's, depending on the level of criminality. And I called this guy up, and he said, meet me tomorrow morning at the Howard Johnson's. So I did. And he said, don't smoke any of that crap either. How did he know? And so I went vibrating into this restaurant, and there's this guy, and he starts talking about himself and talking about himself. And he had problems in his life, and then he met Alcoholics Anonymous, and he didn't have any problems anymore, and he's talking about himself, talking about himself, talking about himself. It's been a half an hour, and he's still going. Now, I haven't had anything to drink yet this morning, and this guy, shut up. So So I say to him, I figure, well, I'll prompt him and maybe he'll close me and I can get the hell out of there. And so I say, do I need psychiatric treatment? Do I need religion? Do I require hospitalization? And this guy looked right through me and he said, listen, kid. He said, a hospital will cost about $3,000. If your family or you can get your hands on $3,000, he said, take that money out and drink it all up. And when you're done, call Alcoholics Anonymous. They do it for fun and for free. And then this guy got up and he looked at me and he said, kid, if you want AA, you're going to have to go after it the way you went after your booze and your drugs. They're in the white pages of the phone book. Good luck. And he left. I didn't even know there was a New York office I could report him to. You know, I mean, this guy just left. And he didn't take me by the hand and guide me into Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, go look in the phone book, kid. Now, this is a very, you know, for some of you younger folks, these were things that, phones were things that hung on a wall. And if you wanted to talk to somebody that wasn't in the room, you had to stand by a wall and hope that they were someplace by a wall where they could get the call. It's a very odd way to live. You should try and tell that to sponsees now. Oh, you didn't return my call. But anyway, so I go home to my grandmother's house, and I poured myself a water glass full of whiskey with 3 ice cubes, and I drank it down. And I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was on the second day of May in 1979. And a woman answered the phone, and she said, Alcoholics Anonymous, may we help you? She said, are you drinking? Well, the glass wasn't in my mouth, right? So, no, I'm not drinking. She says to me, well, we can have somebody come by and get you. Or where are you? And I gave her where I was. And she said, there's a club down the street about 3 miles away. There's a meeting at noon. Why don't you show up? Well, it was about 10:30. I thanked her. I hung up the phone. I thought about it for a few minutes. And so I showed up at the noon meeting. Now, I showed up at 12:30 because you never show up at the party on time, right? You always show up just a little late. And I go vibrating into the room because I ain't had but about 4 or 5 ounces of booze to drink, so I'm starting to get the zup-zups, you know. And I walk in, and the woman behind the coffee bar says, you, upstairs. And so I walk up these 12 steps into this meeting hall, and they're sitting around, and there's the steps, traditions on the wall. And I sit down, and everybody starts talking at me. And I can't understand why they're talking at me. But I haven't described to you my appearance when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I was very stylish. My wardrobe consisted of a good T-shirt and a bad T-shirt, a pair of Levi's, and a pair of bowling shoes. In the States, when you go to a bowling alley, you have to give them your shoes in order to get bowling shoes. I'm the reason why. I came to kind of near a bowling alley in Santa Rosa, California, and I boogied in and gave them the money to bowl a couple of lanes, and then I left with the shoes because the Goodwill wasn't open yet. So anyway, and you can tell that I spend a lot of money getting my hair styled every 6-8 months. And when my hair's long, I look like the Sphinx. And I'm smoking, and it looks like a napalm strike has been called in. Just and I was fortunate enough to come into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous where everybody was talking about or could talk about recovery from alcoholism. And it was an incredible group. Joyce had come to the meeting. She had just been released from the nut house. And she came back to AA instead of going to the bar. And everybody was thrilled to see her. There was a guy, Frank D. He had a Sergeant Pepper's coat on. And the way he shared, you could tell that he'd eaten a lot of LSD, which was very important for me. I didn't know that you could do that and stay sober. And at the end of his pitch, he screams, "Work the steps or die, motherfucker." The third guy that talked was a guy by the name of Butcher Joe. Now, you can always tell Butcher Joe. His name is Joe Hacker. I kid you not, you can't make this stuff up. And he talked about his life. And he talked about the way drink made him feel. It was the first thing that made him feel whole. And he talked about losing control and about how when his family left him, his dearest, dearest thing, that inside what he felt was, yes, now they're gone and nobody can mess with my drinking. I understood this. And he talked about knowing just how deeply to cut himself, that at work they couldn't put a little butterfly on him. They'd have to take him to hospital. And on the way to hospital, he could get the drink that he needed. And I understood that. How did he know? See, I spent a lot of years tending bar, and before, when I was drinking, I learned how to eat a beer glass and set up a bet so that when I ran out of money, I could eat. I'd set up a bet with the bartender, and we'd take money bets from all the people in the bar, and I'd sit there and eat the beer glass, and we'd split the money. Yeah. How did he know? The nice thing about that, if you have to go and try it, is that you only get about 4 bites down before somebody says, "Oh, Daddy, make him stop. Take the money." So you don't have to eat the whole glass. Just enough to let him know that you will. And he looked right through me, and he said, "You don't ever have to feel the way that you feel about yourself ever again if you're willing to do what I've done." And that's the only thing That is the entire reason that I came from Sedona, Arizona, is to bring that message. That you don't need to feel the way that you feel about yourself ever again if you're willing to do the stuff that I've done. Now, this is a great, vibrant group. And there are people that are sitting in here today that are separated from drink a long time. And by a long time, I mean 90 days. That's a long time. 5 years, 8 years. Now, this may not happen in Stockholm. But in the United States, there are people sober a long time from drink whose ass is getting kicked by food, by money, by sex. And there are other fellowships that address these things in a language that is specific to the problem where you go, how did they know? And so you don't ever have to suffer, ever again. And nowadays you don't even have to go to the stupid meetings to qualify. You can just go on XA and download a Gamblers Anonymous talk and listen to it. And if you laugh, you're screwed. Or OA or any of that stuff. You know, I used to, with people I worked with, I used to encourage them to go to the meetings, you know, and all that stuff, and they'd just resist until they were dying. Now we can get it to them on the internet. But anyway, so just an opinion. It's a very good one, and it should be yours. So anyway, he says this to me. You don't ever have to feel the way that you feel about yourself ever again. And everybody at that meeting pretty much stuck to that topic. After the meeting, a miracle happened. This was in Manhattan Beach, California. And four guys were going after the meeting down to the Strand to watch girls in bikinis go by on roller skates and play cards. And they took the new man along as entertainment. And in that 3 hours, I learned everything I ever needed to know in Alcoholics Anonymous. They said things like, "This is AA, kid. We don't use no dope here." I was horrified. I had no idea. But they talked about that if I'd identified at the meeting, which I had. Now, at that meeting, these people were talking. They had a language. And I didn't understand all the language, but they were describing the problem in a way that I knew they were talking about what it was that I had. So I identified with that. And what I took away from that first meeting was, it was the front drink that gets you. And I have to do anything I can to stay away from the front drink. So they're saying the reason we don't use no dope is because when you smoke that medicinal marijuana, it was non-habit forming in those days, but medicinal marijuana, sooner or later, you got to cut the cotton mouth, right? And Pepsi's not going to get it at some point. You need a beer, right? I mean, that's why God created beer, to take care of the cotton mouth. They said that was drinking. And if you're doing that Peruvian marching powder, you need a double Bombay on the rocks with a twist. Just to take the edge off, right? That's not drinking, it's just taking the edge off, right? And if you're being really spiritual and you drop some LSD, you need a gallon of Red Mountain wine just to settle through the experience. Wow. Aren't these great chandeliers? Do they move for you? They said that was drinking. And if you had a little cough, and you went down to the store for some cough syrup, and it comes with a shot glass on top of it, you might want to check the contents. It's got alcohol in it. How did they know? Because I've been stuck in some really strange places. Like in the United States, they would have whole states where they didn't serve alcohol on Sundays. It's very inconvenient. So you learn to go down to the store and get NyQuil. And you say, oh, come on, honey, we'll just pretend it's creamed mint on the rocks. But it'll get you through to Monday. It'll get you through. How did they know? They even told me why it was that it's called non-alcoholic beer. Because it's not for alcoholics. Truly, if you look at the label, it says there's alcohol in it.
Well, it's only got 0.003% by volume.
Well, yeah, and that methamphetamine that you're smoking has only had about 0.3% too. But it lights the flame. Now, you may think I'm just some lame guy from California coming telling you what to do, but I'll tell you, my brother-in-law, Douglas, who was a Brit, and you know what bad drunks Brits are, he actually stopped drinking to come to work for me at one point. And he made it 4 whole days until he picked that stuff up. And he was drinking a case of it a day in a week. And he died from cirrhosis of the liver. So this is experience. If it's in the doctor's opinion, in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, Silkworth says the only therapy we have for these allergic types is abstinence from alcohol in any form whatsoever. So these guys taught me, we don't drink, we don't use, we don't go with girls who do. I was good on the front two. The last one I had a little problem with. But so they taught me that. Now, I know that in Sweden there's been a long, long line of very, very deep thinkers, philosophers. And so I've come to like just clear a couple of things up. Number one, the drink bone is connected to the drug bone. So that's why we don't start. Now, if you're a drug addict hiding out in Alcoholics Anonymous, our experience is that the drug bone is connected to the drink bone. So that's why we don't use anything that affects us from the neck up. Okay? That because sooner or later it's gonna tip. In Southern California in the late 60s and early 70s, they had primary purpose meetings where they were only not drinking. They were doing all that other stuff, and nobody could stay sober more than about 3 or 4 years. And these are guys that were stronger than me and more spiritual than me and smarter than me. And they died by drink. So when we talk about this stuff, it's not like an opinion. It's like experience from blood. from Alcoholics Anonymous. So anyway, I get done at this meeting, and these guys get done with me, and I got that I can't use and I can't drink, and that I should be going to meetings. And if I drank every day, I should go to a meeting every day. And so I start. I came in on a Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Friday night, they had a dance at the Alano Club. Now, alcoholics, when they sober up, are the cheapest people in the world. You try and get them to put a little extra money in the basket, and they start screaming to you about traditions that they've never read. The general benchmark for how much you should put in the basket is whatever a beer costs in a bar. Because you had at least one a day. You know. Just an opinion. It's a good one. We'll get to the point that I just go like this. So, anyway, I get an extra dollar, a couple dollars from my grandmother, right? I got the good T-shirt on, and I go vibrating into the dance. Oh, look, Joyce, there's a real comer. And I get in there, and I look around, and the women are like the women here. They've all taken showers. The ones that jog maybe twice. And they're swinging their hips, and they're listening to the music, and they're snapping their fingers, and I realize that I'm 24 years old, and I am never going to get laid again in my life. And I go out of the dance into the Pinto that I was living in, and now that I'm just driving, and I drive towards the Stick and Stein. Now, I'm on the way to that bar, not to drink, just to find a woman that understands. And about a half mile into the drive, the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous happened for me. That still small voice said, "This is not a good idea. Turn the car around." Now, I've heard that voice my entire life. And I've always just gone ahead and done exactly as I pleased. And I turned the car around. And I went back to the Alano Club. And Larry was taking the tickets. And I grabbed him. And I said, "Talk program to me, please." And he got somebody else to watch the door. And he sat me down, and he got me a copy of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd been too cool to buy one. I didn't want to look like I was going to Bible study. And he explained to me that this book is written about you. And if you can find yourself in it, you got a shot, kid. And so I vibrated home with the book, and I started reading it. Now, in those days, I wasn't sleeping yet. I was surrounded by caring nurturers who said, "Nobody died from lack of sleep, kid. You'll get over it." And so all I'm doing is smoking and sweating and walking and smoking and sweating and walking. And so I start reading the book. And the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, is written very, very elegantly if you're withdrawing. And there I got hooked in the... thank you. I got hooked... there where, in the doctor's opinion, where Silkworth is talking about the sense of ease and comfort that comes from a few drinks. Now, how do these lames back in Ohio know anything about that? That's not the language that I'd describe it as. I'd say, you remember when the third drink would stay down? and you can light your own cigarette, and you start to be able to use your whole lung capacity, that's, oh, okay, they know. And I kept reading. Now, I was not interested in World War I or that stock market crash. I just wasn't. And I kept reading, and I completely missed that the whole program's there in about five paragraphs in Bill's story. And I kept reading. Got to all the God stuff. I was not thrilled about that. But you know, when I sat in that first meeting, I realized that with all the gifts that I'd hit the highest point of the lottery just about. Some of you may disagree, but I was born male, Caucasian, and Californian. In the 50s, you can't get any higher of a hit than that. And the best I could do with all of that was end up in Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe for the first time in my life, I ought to pay attention. Maybe for the first time in my life, I ought not to shoot the angles. Maybe for the first time, because I'm an angle shooter. I know you can't tell that. I'll just dummy up and do what these people say to do. Just try it. What the hell? All in. And so I keep reading this stuff, and I get to We Agnostics. And at the end of We Agnostics, there's a story. It's about a guy by the name of Fitz Mayo. And Fitz was the third guy into AA in New York. And he was from a religious family. His dad was a preacher. Later on, his story's in the book called The Preacher's Son. And the money's all gone. His wife hates him. He's got post-war depression, or PTSD, now we call it. Everybody hates him. He knows, and they're talking about God, and this is the worst thing that can ever happen to anybody that's got any sense at all. And he's really up against it. And the still small voice inside of him says, "Who are you to say that there is no God?" And he heard that, and he snapped too, and he dropped down on his knees, and he said a prayer. And he had this huge white light experience, and he never drank again. I understood the story. So I did what he did. I got down on my knees, and I said my prayer. I don't know from Jesus or Buddha. I don't know the Talmud, the Torah, the Upanishads. Just please get me the top. I'll do whatever these dried up old geeks say to do. Just please help me not to drink. And at the end of that prayer, I believe I had done the first three steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That prayer was perfect. I'm with you tonight. Now, I didn't have any white light experience or anything like that. I just went, okay. Now, I didn't know I'd done the first three steps, and I just got up and lit another cigarette and read and walked and smoked and stuff. So next morning, Saturday morning, the Alano Club, where all the meetings are, opens at 10. So I'm there at 9:30 smoking, waiting for it to open. Then go in, get some coffee, sit there and smoke, wait for the noon meeting. God had not created morning meetings yet. It's all right. It's best to work alone. So I'm sitting, I got the bad t-shirt on. I'm on a naga hide couch, stuck to it, smoking. And this woman walks through and she's got a bun in her hair and a black dress on and correct hose. And she walks in and she goes, "Oh, young man, you're new, aren't you?" "How can you tell?" She says, "I can tell you the secret of Alcoholics Anonymous in 4 words. "Oh, what are they?" "Find God or die." "No! Not that! Oh, please, not that!" Later, I didn't tell you the secret of Alcoholics Anonymous in 4 words. Find God and live. And live joyously. And live wondrously. Live in the fourth dimension of existence. And when I say God, I'm not saying what you think I'm saying. I'm talking about an experience, an aggregate of experience that I have had in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's a really short word that's very, very open-ended. And I'll talk a lot about this weekend, and there'll be some fun stuff that we do. But anyway, this woman scared me to death. So I went into the meeting, and I got a sponsor because I needed protection. And I'm an active AA guy, okay? I go around and I do all kinds of stuff. And I will never, ever, ever be able to repay that man and his Al-Anon wife. They literally saved my life. That first few days, I'd show up on my sponsor's porch and sit there and smoke because I was baffled. I didn't know how not to drink. And when his Al-Anon wife would come home, she'd open the door. She'd put on a cup of coffee. She'd let me sit there until my sponsor came home. That is love. That is whatever you want to call it, whatever is. That is the embodiment of that. When I was 28 days sober, or 24 days sober, I was reading the big book unsupervised. You could do that in the 70s. And I got to chapter 5 where they're talking about the fourth step, and if you don't do an inventory, you're going to drink. So I run to my sponsor, and I say, "Oh, my God, I'm going to drink. It says so right here. I haven't done an inventory yet." And he said, "Oh, come on, kid, relax." He gave me my four-step guide, 2 pieces of paper with a line down the center of each. He told me a couple really embarrassing things about himself. He told me, "Go home, look at the, get really jacked up on coffee. This is before Starbucks, so it took a while. You had to brew a bunch and ramp up." And he said, "Take a look at the door, the kitchen." And he said, "Think about your family. And just have them walk through the door one by one. And if your stomach goes like this, write their name down. Then you get 3 sentences as to why. Nobody's life is that interesting, kid." He said, "And then, you know, I want you to write about this and this." And he said, you know, and so I did my first inventory. Was it a fearless and thorough moral inventory using all 4 columns? No. It was the greatest hits. That's all that needs to be on that first inventory, is the stuff that goes around and around and around. around and around in your mind. That's what goes on there. Now, I know this doesn't happen in Stockholm, but in the United States, there's this whole thing where somebody gets sober and they welcome him in. They go, oh, my God, you're Kevin. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a wonderful life.
Watch out for the inventory.
Now, first, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is made for alcoholics. They're about this deep. It's not that complex. All we're asking any alcoholic woman or man to do is to go home tonight and write a list of who you hate. How hard is this? Then, who you're afraid of? Her. Her mother. Her sister. County sheriffs. Lawyers. I mean, it's not that big a deal. This is what we're talking about. I mean, it's, and then, you know, you, after that, it's like, it took me about 4.5 hours. My sponsor came, and I was writing really big, and my sponsor came over. We did this stupid prayers. We burned it.
Oh, my God, what happened to your eighth step, your list?
Believe me, I knew all these people. It was not a big deal. And he sent me out to start making my amends. I'm 28 days sober. And I'm a fully vested member of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Well, the only requirement for membership is the desire to
stop drinking. You can do the first four steps by yourself. It's the fifth step that we actually do something. And when I did my fifth step, my sponsor took me around the meeting and said, he's okay, you can talk to him now. He's in. Yeah, you write down the sexual weirdness. We've all got it. The reason I believe that alcoholism is a disease more now today than I did 35 years ago is I've heard way too many inventories. We're alcoholic males. There's not that much we can do to destroy ourselves. Some of us may be a little more flamboyant than others. But really, it's the same. And I'm convinced that with my sisters, it's the same exact thing. Sam Shoemaker, who was Bill Wilson's spiritual mentor, said there's only one sin. Which one? Thinking that I'm different. And it's in that holy place, in that fifth step, that we find out that we're just another alcoholic woman or man. And it's not that, this is not rocket science. I'll leave you with one thing, and then we'll take a break. I think the coffee's ready, right? What was the one thing? Oh, yeah.
Well, what about the deep, dark things down below?
You don't have to worry. They'll get in contact with you. You don't drink a while. Oh, that's why Uncle Fred was the one I didn't want to be in the same room with. Now I remember. It's no big deal. Because when that comes up, we deal with it. So, welcome. We're going to have some fun. Let's take a break. Come back in how long? 10? Now, we're going to do this in alcoholic time.
The chair says 10 minutes.
Best of luck. We'll see you soon. Thanks.